This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, Indianapolis philanthro-trekker and author Jeff Raisley shares the subject of his new book about bringing modern amenities to a remote village in the Himalayas. And later, Dr. Babar Khan with the Regenstrief Institute talks about what COVID-19 survivors face after they leave the ICU. But first, a look at this week's headlines from Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. It was a big news week, as all of them have been lately. Where do we start? How about the numbers this week?
Yeah, so as of noon today, 2,214 people have died from COVID-19. There are more than 39,000 confirmed cases and more than 335,000 Hoosiers have been tested so far. Now, to compare that to last week we were at 2,078 people who had died, more than 36,000 confirmed cases, and more than 291,000 Hoosiers who had been tested. So testing has continued to increase. And in fact, over the last 3 weeks, we've averaged about 6,000 tests. Is that right? 6,000 tests per week. So it's also important to note that this week the state announced a testing partnership with Eli Lilly and the Indiana Hospital Association to double its testing capacity in the next month. To launch the network, the state bought $60 million worth of testing reagents, and participating labs will then purchase those supplies from the state. And this new network will also use the state's buying power to purchase new equipment, likely beginning sometime in August. State Health Commissioner Chris Bach says the plan is to buy different testing machines that work with different reagents to ensure that a shortfall in certain reagents won't dramatically decrease the state's testing capacity in the future.
Well, it sounds like testing is really going up. You said, what was it, a couple of weeks ago we were averaging 6,000 a week, and then within the last couple of weeks it looks like the average went up to 20,000 per week?
Yeah, I'm trying to find that story again. It's something, I think it's the last 3 weeks averaging about 6,000 tests per day.
Oh, per day.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's, I mean, everything has dramatically increased because of the testing partnership with OptumServe, making things more accessible and opening the net of people that are allowed to receive tests, people who have concerns about being exposed, people in high risk groups are able to be tested without, you know, necessarily having a doctor's note for specifically the OptumServe testing sites. So that has all contributed to getting more people tested, you know, throughout the state.
Yeah, testing really ramping up, plus the $60 million worth of testing reagents. Great, great news there. So stage four of the Back on Track plan is going to start early. When is early?
Today.
All right.
We're already in it. Stage four of the Back on Track plan started today. It was supposed to start on Sunday. The governor bumped that up and announced that he was bumping that up on Wednesday. So stage four allows groups of up to 250 people to gather. Retail stores no longer have capacity limits, though the state still urges proper social distancing. And cultural and entertainment tourism sites like museums, zoos, aquariums, movie theaters, bowling alleys are all allowed to open up to 50% of capacity for the first time since the stay-at-home order was enacted. Festivals, parades, fairs, and carnivals remain closed in stage four. And then racing venues may reopen to the public at half capacity beginning today.
But the big race, the 400 at IMS on 4th of July weekend, will not have any fans, though, as I understand it.
Yes. I'm less familiar with that. Despite growing up on the West Side, there's just a chunk of my brain that does not obtain any information about the Indy 500, the Brickyard 400, or anything to do with racing. I spent so much of my childhood listening to the sounds of the racetrack that it just does not stick in adulthood.
Well, it is certainly interesting to hear about stage four reopening a couple of days early. I wonder if the weather had anything to do with that. Well, casinos, though, will be reopening just after this weekend, it looks like.
Yeah. So beginning June 15th, so kind of going back a second, casinos were required to submit health and safety plans before the state would allow them to reopen. And those plans were detailed. Employees, patrons, and vendors will undergo daily health screenings, and employees can't be penalized for missing work if they have COVID-19 symptoms or test positive for the virus. And so the State Gaming Commission says they can open to the public at reduced capacity beginning June 15th. Local communities can impose tougher restrictions on casinos or even prevent them from opening entirely, but no community has announced their intent to do so. And the outlines of the plan details, include a lot of things: the number of people allowed at tables, the distance between slot machines, you know, kind of every base is covered under those. And then the individual casinos are also providing their plans as well.
I just spoke with a friend who used to work at one of Indiana's casinos, and he used to work is the key word there. And he said he was so glad that he found another job just before the pandemic hit. He would have been hit pretty hard and would not have liked some of the restrictions that are going to be required once the casinos reopen this coming Monday. Mm-hmm. Interesting perspective from him. And we got some interesting news this week from the state superintendent about schools reopening this coming fall. What did we hear?
Yeah, so this all kind of starts last Friday, shortly after the pitch-in. The state unveiled a set of guidelines for schools to consider as they bring people back to campuses. The guidance recommends schools screen staff and students for COVID-19 symptoms and that people in schools wear masks. It says that schools will likely need to provide masks to staff and students and follow social distancing rules. And the document says that schools should maintain social distancing and offers options for them to consider to limit the movement and face-to-face interactions of students, including changing the length and timing of school breaks, classroom layouts, and busing procedures. So then all of that's announced on Friday. On Tuesday, the state superintendent of public instruction, Jennifer McCormick, said it's largely up to local health departments to decide if schools are doing enough. McCormick says the governor plans to buy 2 million masks to distribute to schools and that her department is still reviewing how that will be done. But depending on how stringent a local health department is with in-person classes, the cost of bringing students back and following some of those guidelines could be substantial for school districts. The Indiana State Teachers Association and the Indiana Small and Rural Schools Association both say the cost could be different from district to district. All of this is on top of the fact that some schools plan to start the 2020-2021 school year in late July, leaving them about 6 weeks to get everything, to get the show on the road.
So some local autonomy is allowed with respect to schools reopening in Indiana, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, the guidelines, the guidance itself is very much that, right? So it's not, the state isn't kind of, isn't decreeing what schools have to do or what they must do. They're very much saying, you have the power, you know how best to work with your students. But the main concern that school advocates have seemed to have is the cost of trying to figure that out. Like, even from just like having different busing schedules or adjusting classroom size, like that all costs money. And you have school districts that don't have that money because of a myriad of reasons. So the one thing that the governor is doing, purchasing 2 million masks to distribute to schools, alleviates a fraction of that burden. But just the logistical challenges seem very overwhelming for a lot of school advocates.
And of course, the other big story is are the continuing protests. And you began covering the protests when they started a couple of weekends ago, and they are continuing in parts of the state. Downtown Indianapolis, there are still protests happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are protests happening all across the state. They've been substantially smaller this week, especially in Indianapolis. The protests have been have been smaller because they've been ramping up to weekend protests, especially in light of IMPD releasing the names of the officers involved in Drayshawn Reed's death, and today releasing the names of the officers involved in Mikhail Rose's death. They protesters have, you know, gathered. I say smaller, it's still 200 people gathering in the streets of Indianapolis. But this weekend, especially in Indy, there is an expectation of a fairly substantial crowd on Friday. Today's expected to be a little bit big. Saturday's supposed to be very big. And Sunday is also supposed to be very big because of a few folks that have been tied into that protest. So Tamika Catchings, formerly of the Indiana Fever, and George Hill, formerly of the Indiana Pacers. Both of them were players. Tamika Catchings, I believe, is still involved in the organization. They are participating in protests that also include voter registration. So those should be pretty big.
And our Indiana Public Broadcasting News team will continue to cover that. And let's talk about the Indiana 2022 way. We're still covering COVID-19.
We're still covering elections. And in fact, next Wednesday, we are partnering with All In to have a discussion about state party conventions and how several statewide elected officials are selected outside of a traditional primary process. So to join, text elections to 73224. And that's to join the Indiana 2022 way. We have a conversation with you every single week. We send you stories. We ask you questions, and that kind of feedback informs the stories that we do every single day.
And that partnership with our show, All In, will, of course, result in a Facebook Live, which will be next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And that will then be repurposed for the radio the following day, next Thursday. And I look forward to that conversation. She is our full-time digital producer and part-time angel, Lauren Chapman. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Part-time.
Part-time angel. That makes sense.
I talk to you in private. Up next, when Indianapolis author Jeff Raisley talks to us about his book on his work to bring modern amenities to a remote Himalayan village, he talks about how they welcomed him during a trek back in 2008. I'm Matt Pelser. We will hear from him in just 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. When Indianapolis-based author and mountaineer Jeff Raisley made it into a small Nepali village in 2008, he found a community that was hundreds of years behind technologically, but one that was friendly, accommodating, and full of very happy people. Since then, Jeff has worked to carefully bring modern improvements to the village and has written about his experiences philanthro-trekking in the Himalayas. His most recent book is titled You Have to Get Lost Before You Can Be Found. And he joins us now. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Namaste, Matt.
So take us to the beginning of this story. What brought you to the Himalayas in the first place?
Well, it's kind of funny and slightly embarrassing. But the first time I went to the Nepal Himalayas was because I had just turned 40 and my wife informed me that I was manifesting midlife crisis symptoms. So I came home from the office one day. She slapped a brochure down on the table in front of me, which was about trekking the Mount Everest Base Camp Trail, and said, "Why don't you go do this?" So she was saying, "Hey, buddy, go take a hike and do it on the other side of the world." And I gladly accepted her offer of therapy.
And that it seems like that really transformed you. What came next?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I've spent most of my life in the flatlands of our Hoosier state, so I had no background in mountaineering or even, you know, high altitude trekking, anything like that. But so trekking the Base Camp Trail back in 1995 was just this glorious experience. And I fell in love with the mountains, just the majesty, the beauty of these gigantic, spectacular looking mountains. But I was also very moved by the people that lived up in the high Himalayas. Most of the people I met that first time were Sherpas. And Sir Edmund Hillary described the Sherpas as the strongest and the kindest people in the world. And I, my experience verified that. So I wanted to go back.
So the title of the book is You Have to Get Lost Before You Can Be Found. Were you literally lost when you came upon this village that you later decided to help?
No, I wasn't. The title of the book is based on two things, really. It's a metaphor for me feeling lost, sort of existentially alienated, the first time I went, and then finding this new role in life in Nepal. But then also I had an experience where I was literally lost, alone, one time in the Himalayas because I sort of foolishly went off to climb this mountain and left my guide and the rest of our team behind, and I got lost. Shouldn't do that sort of thing without your guide. But anyway, and so the book ends with that particular experience describing what it was like to be lost, and then the being found was finding my team and our guys back in base camp, and just the warmth and wonder of community. And that's something I've written a lot about, is how meaning is found through community and communal involvement. So that's where the title comes from. But now, the first time I went to Basa Village in 2008, it was quite an experience getting there, because our original trekking group had 10 people in it, and only three of us actually made it to the village. So we lost people along the way, not to death, but people dropping out, getting hurt, getting sick, not even being able to make the flight to Nepal. Mm. But so when I got to the village, like you said, I just found these warm, wonderful, delightful people who welcomed me into their village, and I've been connected with them ever since.
Can you describe the kind of conditions these people were living in?
Yeah, it's sort of like if you try to imagine what village life might have been 1,000 years ago. There's no running water, no electricity, no television, TV, radio, not even any vehicles with wheels, not even carts. So they did their farming with hand plows or a plow behind a water buffalo. And so from our point of view, life was very primitive, but it was also very beautiful because without all these distractions that we have in modern life, all the ways we stimulate ourselves, well, they didn't have any of those. So they concentrated on relationships. And they, if you met a Basa villager and pointed to somebody else in the village and said, well, you know, tell me about that guy, this person could relate the genealogy of every other person in the village 5 generations back. That's just because relationships were where they found meaning, found their identity. Individualism came second to community, tribal involvement. And then also nature worship. They don't have a formal religion per se. They are what we would call animists. They think God is in everything. Everything has spirit, and so they are sort of super environmentalists, and just, you know, they love nature. Their basic art form is taking flowers, because every home has a flower garden, and then they make things out of flowers. lays and flower jewelry, flower art. So it's a beautiful life, although a hard life.
So what then did you grapple with when you thought about whether or not, or how, I suppose, to help these people, to give them enough modern amenities to help them, but not so many that it changes them who they are fundamentally, I suppose?
Yeah, it's a great question, Matt. The first book I wrote about my experiences in Nepal, that was actually the central theme of the book, because I, on the one hand, I admired these folks so much, and on the other hand, they were asking me to, in some ways, help bring their village into the modern world. And I worried a lot about, you know, would this change? And so the first project I worked on was their village school, which was really the only aspect of modern life that they had. They had a school with three grades, and they asked me if I would raise $5,000, and with $5,000, they could buy the materials for a fourth and a fifth grade classroom and pay two teachers' salaries for 3 years, which is amazing when you think $5,000 could go that far. But I agreed to do it, and then that was the start. That was done in 2008, and since then we've done a water project, so there's running water in the village, a hydroelectric project, so there's electricity. The school has laptop computers, a library. Every home now has a what we call a smokeless stove to vent the smoke off of their cooking and heating out of their houses. Our latest project is just finishing construction, is a little medical clinic not far from the village. It's not in the village, but so it'll help other villages too. And so, you know, you can see in just such a short period of time, just since 2008, the village has changed dramatically in that sense. There's even now a road for the first time that reaches the village, and cell phone service reaches the village. They don't have internet yet, but that's coming.
We're talking to Indianapolis-based author and mountaineer Jeff Raisley, who is the author of You Have to Get Lost Before You Can Be Found, about his experience philanthro-trekking in the Himalayas. Jeff, what did these people know about the modern world? Did they know enough to know what they wanted from it? It sounds like they might have.
Well, yeah, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. The only employment outside of the village is in the trekking business. Mm. So the villagers get hired primarily by the company that I work with over in Nepal called Adventure Geotreks, as they work as porters, guides, cooks. And so they would be, you know, they'd spend a few weeks on treks or mountaineering expeditions with people from the modern world, you know, people like me. And they'd see the way we dressed and see, you know, modern devices that we had, cameras, satellite phones, eventually cell phones, that kind of thing. And they're curious, you know, so we had conversation about what their lives were like, what our lives were like. And so they did have some knowledge, but it was really sweet when we were talking about doing a hydroelectric project. I asked, you know, why do you want electricity? And they said, well, we can see these lights across this huge valley that they live on the mountainside. On the other side of the valley at night, they could see these sparkling lights. And they said, we'd like that too. And the teachers in the school said, well, we would like lights so that our students could study at night and we could prepare at night as well, because they, you know, open fires were the only lights that they had.
Was it a challenge to integrate? Did you find that it was a challenge to integrate their way of life with the improvements that were made? Are they, I guess, small enough changes that they won't fundamentally alter their culture?
Well, one of the guiding principles that we have followed when I turned the project work into a formal foundation called the Bassa Village Foundation was that we would never suggest that the village change. All of the requests for, you know, things like electricity and running water would have to come from them. And so that was very intentional, that we're not going to try to impose our way of life on you, but we'll help you as you decide what modern technologies and, you know, sanitation, education, et cetera, that you want to bring to the village. And then we would provide financial help and expertise with engineering if they needed it. But they, every project we've done, the villagers actually do all the work. So they built the school, they built the hydroelectric system, they built the water system themselves, and then they choose, they've created a school board, a utility board, so that they own it, they run it. So all these changes are really their decisions, and then they own and run it. So it isn't just like, you know, we build something for them and, you know, that they then create a sort of a culture of dependency on us. It's, you know, they own it, they build it, they run it. And I think that has a lot to do with integrating it into their culture. One of the kind of, just a little interesting story, they have on their fire pits, three sacred stones. And these stones tell people where to sit. There's a father, mother, child stone. And I was really worried when we did the smokeless stove project that, you know, this hundreds of years old tradition would be lost if they sat around the stove instead of sitting around the fire pit. And some of the villagers put the stove right on top of the fire pit, on top of the stones. Others put it in the corner and maintain the fire pit in the center of their home. And so I asked some of the villagers that put the stove on top of the stones, I said, you know, gee, what about the sacred stones? And their response was, we know where they are, and we still sit according to mother, father, child stone. So that, you know, that's kind of some relief that their traditions are so deeply ingrained and have been passed down for so many generations. At this point, you know, it looks like their culture is still pretty strong, but, you know, it's an ongoing experiment.
You've written that age and injuries have sidelined you from a lot of the activities that brought you to the village in the first place. Do you think you'll ever make it back there?
I don't know. Because of age and some injuries, I don't really feel like I'm up to doing any Himalayan mountain climbing anymore. I'm still very capable of doing high altitude trekking, and the last time I went to the village, I limped there with a pulled Achilles tendon and a little tear in my calf muscle. So even though I had to cross two 10,000 foot high passes, you know, I made it. So I could go. I stepped down as president of the foundation a couple of years ago. I'm still on the board and still very active in it. But I, you know, younger people, you know, you got to pass that torch on to the younger generation. And I'm very pleased with the younger leadership that's taking over the foundation. So maybe, maybe not.
Do you feel satisfied with what you've managed to do so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where if you think about life as being a surfer and it just a wave comes along and you ride it. You know, this was a wave I never really expected, but I got on it and I've ridden it, and I'm still riding it. And it's a beautiful wave to ride. I'm in contact regularly still with people from the village. Now that they have laptops there, we can email each other, especially the ones who've left the village and live in Kathmandu. So, I do feel good about it. And they call me the godfather of the village, or Jeff Dai, which means big brother. And it's heartwarming.
Wow. Jeff Raisley is from Indianapolis, and he's the author of You Have to Get Lost Before You Can Be Found, a memoir of suffering, grit, and love of the Himalayas in Bossa Village. It's out now. Jeff, thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much, Matt. It was a joy talking to you.
Up next, we hear a lot about positive cases and deaths from COVID-19, but what about the people who survive the ICU? We'll hear from a critical care physician from the IU School of Medicine about some of the difficulties some sufferers and their caregivers face once they make it out of intensive care. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Yes, COVID-19 has a high survivability rate, but for those who contract the virus and suffer the worst of its symptoms, but still manage to survive, the recovery process is anything but easy. Dr. Babar Khan is a research scientist with the Regenstrief Institute and a critical care physician with the IU School of Medicine. He's developed a care model to help ICU survivors with the kinds of impairments they face after they get off the ventilator. Dr. Khan, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So let's start by illustrating what is happening with someone who's on a ventilator. What are they going through?
Well, imagine that you're not able to breathe enough and not able to keep your oxygen levels and other things that you usually maintain while you breathe in an optimal range, that you need to be put on a breathing machine, which in a technical term we call mechanical ventilator. Now, once you're on a mechanical ventilator, you have a tube going down your throat, which makes you uncomfortable. For that, we need to give you some medicine so you can tolerate that tube and get over the sensations of pain that could happen with the tube. Now, with that, we control your pain. But one of the functions of all those pain medicines is to make you slowly sleepy. And that we also achieve by adding some other medications called the sedatives. And all of that together, which provides some comfort for your pain and for your anxiety, it also clouds your consciousness. Combine that with your severity of illness, you are predisposed because of your illness factors, and on top of that, the medications and other things that are happening in the intensive care unit, you're predisposed to develop this acute confusion of the mind, which we call delirium, which is extremely prevalent in the intensive care unit because of all the other factors that I have discussed. Now, in the middle of the COVID pandemic, the other thing that happened is because of the visitation restrictions. Now, you have a patient in the ICU who's severely ill with COVID-19, unable to breathe, on a mechanical ventilator with a tube down their throat, connected to a lot of other machines with all sorts of monitors and bells and whistles going on, and not having their family member present. You put this all together, and then this is a recipe for developing confusion, developing anxiety, developing stress, and being alone in the middle of your illness.
I guess I would have assumed that the delirium came from what I would have thought was a lack of oxygen from being on the ventilator and being in sort of this rhythmic pattern. And is it enough for your brain? But you say it's the drugs that is causing the delirium.
Right. So delirium is a condition in which we are not behaving the way we should be behaving. Our mind is not doing what it's supposed to be doing. We are confused. We are not oriented. We are not attentive. Now, when you're in the intensive care unit, there are multiple factors that can predispose you to develop delirium, and we call them the risk factors. And on an average, a person in the ICU is exposed to up to 8 to 10 risk factors that can predispose to delirium. Now, one of them is low oxygen, which could be one of the factors to cause confusion. And in order to get over that low oxygen, we put you on the mechanical ventilator and provide you higher levels of oxygen to get your oxygen levels up to a range where you can function properly, at least your body organs. Now, but in order to do that, we need to do certain other things. We need to give you medicines for pain, as I said. We need to give you medicines for sedation, that some of them can predispose you to develop delirium. Now, the other conditions that sometimes we need to do in order to help you breathe optimally is to put you on medicines such as paralytics. But in order to put you on paralytics, we have to sedate you deeply and induce a state of coma. Now, coma is an independent risk factor for delirium. On top of this, you can develop shock. You can develop sepsis, which is an infectious state. And the patients with COVID are developing something we call the cytokine storming, which is essentially a technical term that there's so much inflammation in the body that they are behaving like they're infected, and the body is behaving in that way, which could be a risk factor for developing delirium. So that's why I'm saying that when you put all of this together, you create a condition where patients are at risk for developing delirium, and not only developing delirium for longer duration, because the average stay in the ICU for people on mechanical ventilation when they have COVID-19 is up to 2 weeks, and then also developing delirium with a higher severity.
So say it comes time for a patient to come off the ventilator. Good news, of course, but what does that look like for the patient initially?
Right. So we used to have a saying in the ICU that, okay, well, you have get over your initial illness, and now we have taken the tube out and you're ready to get out of the ICU. And it was thought that that is a battle that has been won by the ICU doctors, that we have saved your life and you're ready to go back to the community. Now, with our work over the last 8 to 10 years, what we have realized that patients, when they survive the ICU stay, they have to deal with the concept or the sequelae of staying in the ICU. And being in the ICU is a very small part of the recovery process. You can see that the patients with COVID-19, if they say the average stay in the ICU is up to 2 weeks, then if you look at survivorship, that survivorship is going to last years after getting out of the ICU.
Wow.
So when you look at it, you say, okay, well, we have won the initial battle, but we have a war that is going to rage for years after discharge, because COVID-19 ICU survivors will have to deal with this entity we call the post-intensive care syndrome.
And you've run a survivorship, an ICU survivorship clinic for quite some time now. Are the kinds of impairments COVID-19 sufferers facing Is that pretty typical among anyone who comes off of a ventilator? Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. So we have been running this ICU survivorship clinic called the Critical Care Recovery Center since 2011. We were the first one in the United States to develop the clinic. Now, what we have found out that people who are on the mechanical ventilator, and if they have problems with breathing and they have conditions which is similar to COVID-19 subjects that they are facing, there's a high burden of developing cognitive impairment, which is essentially symptoms of dementia-like symptoms with memory, attention, and executive function that can occur in people who survive the mechanical ventilation. On top of that, 30% of ICU survivors can have symptoms of depression, anxiety. Up to 24% of them can develop symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And on top of that, because you're on a mechanical ventilator and you're not moving, you develop this critical illness myopathy, which essentially means that you're physically impaired when you get off the ventilator. And then up to 80% of them can have problems up to 6 months, and 70% of them can have problems up to 12 months after discharge from the intensive care unit. Now, when you put these together, the cognitive impairment, which is essentially new memory problems or new attention problems coming out of the ICU, symptoms of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or worsening if you already have depression or anxiety, and then these functional impairments, they all constitute post-intensive care syndrome. And up to 50 to 70% of ICU survivors can have post-intensive care syndrome symptoms. Now, the COVID-19 ICU survivor, although it's a new pandemic and we are still learning about it, the COVID-19 ICU survivor, I would expect is to behave similar to other ICU survivors, if not worse, because the COVID-19 is causing the severe form of lung injury, which is prompting them to be on mechanical ventilation for longer duration. And we would suspect that these folks, when they come out of the ICU, will have a higher burden of post-intensive care syndrome. Now we are lucky that at Indiana University and in Indianapolis, we have developed this model and that we have had experience with that. So we are plugging all of our COVID-19 ICU survivors to come and see us in our clinic. And we are also scaling our model of care in the health system so that we have a pathway of transition to recovery for these COVID-19 ICU survivors.
We're talking with Dr. Babar Khan, a research scientist with the Regenstrief Institute and a critical care physician with the IU School of Medicine. He's developed a care model for ICU survivors. And of course, today we're talking about that in the through the lens of COVID-19. And when you were talking about the road ahead for COVID-19 survivors who have been through the ICU, who have come off the ventilator, you used the word years as the timeline. I mean, what does that timeline look like? What are they able to overcome first? And then, I guess, what is last in the road to back to normal, if there is such a thing?
Right. So I think that this is going to be a very, very individualized sort of recovery for COVID-19 ICU survivors.
Sure.
What we want to get to a survivor and their family members and their informal caregivers is that once they come out of the ICU, they will have trouble with certain things that we may not be thinking about. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that when we did a survey of our caregivers, of our ICU survivors, what they realized that they did not have enough information of what would be happening to the ICU survivor once they're coming back home. So these are the things that we need to realize, not only the caregivers, not only the COVID-19 ICU survivors, but also their primary care providers. Now, what usually happens in the recovery process is that the patients started recovering physically because they go through physical rehab when they come out of the ICU. And that is one of the things that most of the ICU systems realize, that patients are weak and they would need exercise therapy and occupational therapy so that they can improve their physical performance. That is one of the aspects that usually get better. The aspect that gets overlooked is the brain function, one of those where cognition, and it can take up to 12 months for their cognition to be at the levels where it was before getting admitted to the ICU. Wow. And that could have an impact on the quality of life of the COVID-19 ICU survivors. There was a survey done before, and then the ICU survivors were asked that if they think what would be the thing that would affect the most, and they said that it's the cognition aspect that they think would be related most to their quality of life. So that would be the aspect that would take time. The other thing that is essentially very, very difficult to overcome are these depression and anxiety symptoms. And those are the things that people would not like to acknowledge. And those are the things we regularly don't screen among these ICU survivors. So that is one of the other things that need to be dealt with. And those are the symptoms that can become a chronic disorder after surviving the ICU and that needs to be managed. And that could persist up to years after discharge, the symptoms of depression and post-traumatic stress disorder.
How many of the recent patients in your ICU survivorship clinic have been COVID-19 survivors? Is it the majority?
So for the last 4 weeks in my clinic, all I'm being seeing are the COVID-19 ICU survivors.
Wow. The only patients have been COVID-19 survivors over the last four
right.
weeks. Wow.
Yeah. And this is what happened in our ICU, that at the peak of the pandemic and at least in the last few months, not now, but at least by April and early May, majority of the patients on the service were COVID-19. And that was not only in one hospital system, but that was also as part of the other hospital systems. And that's what I would expect, that in the coming months, that would be the majority of the patient population that we will be seeing in the ICU survivor clinics.
You mentioned caregivers a moment ago. What are the caregivers going through?
I'm just going to use a quote that one of the caregivers said to us. And she said that very day changed my life. And that was the day that she was saying that her loved one came back home, because what she didn't realize that the problems that they will be dealing with as part of taking care of their loved one who's an ICU survivor. She said, I don't know where to start. Life changed. And I kind of wished I knew the changes. So that was one thing that I think the most important part is for us to give the information to the caregivers that how the recovery process for the ICU survivor will look like. The other thing is if we look at the data that come out from other ICU survivors, what we have found out that the majority of the caregivers will be females when we did a survey. So on that survey, up to 70% were females. And then the other thing that came out is that the caregivers had these feelings of depression themselves, which is up to 40% of them could have these feelings of depression and despair up to a year after ICU discharge by just virtue of taking care of an ICU survivor. So I think this is an important realization that I think that we need to give to the informal caregivers that you will have to go through a road ahead which might be bumpy. And then the other important thing is that we have resources available where we need to, when we are taking care of the ICU survivor, we should be taking care of their family members as well. Like in our clinic, our model is very holistic, and we also screen the caregivers for all the other things that could happen while taking care of an ICU survivor. And we connect them with the resources through our care coordinators to help the caregivers train them, help them and how to take care of the ICU survivor and how to cope with the difficulties that they would be facing. I think one of the most important points that I'm trying to bring out here is the realization that the caregivers will struggle while providing care for the ICU survivors or COVID-19 ICU survivors, but that there are resources, and we all as health system need to realize that we need to help the caregivers so that the caregivers and the ICU survivor will recover together.
In our last minute, I kind of just want to illustrate what the medical ICU looks like right now. How stretched is the system right now?
Well, at this point, the system in Indiana is not that stretched because the numbers of COVID admissions, at least in our ICUs, they have been steady and they are showing a downward trend. When we were at the peak in April, the system was pretty stretched. One of the examples that I can give that usually we would run two teams of ICUs in the hospital, and we were able to expand that up to five teams at that time. But we were able to provide all the care that was needed, and all the patients who needed ventilators were provided ventilators, and all the support that was given. But we were reaching the limits of the capacity. So yeah, so as a state and as a health system across the state, I think the preventive measures and then the other measures that would prevent the rise in the number of cases is super, super important, because if we don't control that, no matter how many resources we put in, we will reach the limit of our resources.
Dr. Babar Khan is a research scientist with the Regan Streiff Institute and a critical care physician with the Indiana University School of Medicine. He also serves as the president of the American Delirium Society. Dr. Khan, thank you for your work and thanks for your time today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. We are a daily talk show, but if we're not on every weekday where you live, you can catch up with our podcast feed. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss a topic you care about. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana for discussion and daily topic alerts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is All In.